Hello and welcome to another episode of At Random. My name's Rick Timmis.
My name is John Wordsworth.
And I'm Jackson Matthews.
On this evening's show, we've got a couple of exciting additions to the show for you this evening. But first of all, we're going to be talking about On Live. Then we're going to be going into our app review and taking a look at the app reviews and some of the information there. We've got a new section, which Jack's going to introduce us to tonight. So I think we'll keep that one secret for a minute. We're, of course, adding in another two tracks from Magnatune. And then finally, we're going over to Deep Thought, where, John, we're going to be talking about...
A little bit about HTML5, JavaScript and CSS.
Fantastic. So, without further ado... Welcome, and let's get started.
So, non-squeaky chair ahoy. Something which I've been reading about this last month is something called OnLive. Mm-hmm. And the main reason I started reading into it and playing with it was because there was a game released in the States which came packaged with a free OnLive version of it. Right. And the company had a similar model and it competed, so they sort of stopped stocking this game. But I mean, that's will become more relevant as I tell you what it is.
Okay.
But OnLive is a system which lets you play games that are actually being run on a computer hundreds of miles away. So it's a little bit like VNCing to a powerful gaming machine and having all of your inputs fed from your keyboard, mouse and joypad straight up to the server, and the server beams a video of what's going on back to you. So instead of... It's hard to explain, but is that clear?
I've got... Yeah, well, I've done loads of stuff with Linux terminal services and using X and remote clients and VNC and stuff like that. And I'm immediately thinking, that won't work. because usually these things are quite blocky and, you know, it's quite difficult, really, even with a reasonable amount of bandwidth. So it'd be interesting to see... They've got to have some challenges with that. It'd be interesting to see how they've got that to work.
Yeah, I mean, what's quite interesting, I mean, I'll tell you a little bit more about the sort of product, I guess, first, is that you can log into this service using your PC, your Mac, or they even sell a tiny little set-top box, which is a bit like Apple TV sized, which is about $100 or something. And then you plug it into your broadband, and then you plug it into your TV, and then you plug a keyboard, mouse, and or joypads into the front. And it's the sort of thing I guess you might see in a hotel. It feels like that, you know, like where you go to a hotel and you're staying there. And then you just turn it on and there happens to be a keyboard in the room which is wireless, and then you can connect up. Because the first screen you're hit with is kind of this Windows Media Player type, you know, type interface where you control it with, you could control it with a remote control in theory. And you can search through your game library. And if you pay $10 a month, then you get access to X hundred games, which form the kind of core playback service. So you can play games that are, I think it's like two plus years old, say. And then if you want to play more modern games, then you pay more to play those.
So it's the £10 one is just like the starting rate kind of thing?
I don't think you need to pay the $10 a month, but you can to get access to their back catalogue.
Right, okay.
So if you just wanted to play one game through this service because your PC's old, like a little... Or if you only have like a laptop at home that just can't play games,
yeah.
Then the idea is you can pay for a copy of your game through OnLive. I don't know if it's cheaper than buying it through, say, Steam. And then you can play your game and the server will retain all your save game information, so it's like you're playing it on one machine. But you can play it from any machine on your home network or anywhere around the world. So if you're kicking back in an airport with a netbook, for instance, then you could quite happily just log into your game and carry on from there. And it doesn't matter that you're running it on a rubbish little netbook, because essentially what you've got is a screen which you can interact with, but all your interactions are pushed straight to the server, and what it feeds back looks like it's coming through YouTube, so it looks like it's been compressed into MP4 or some other codec before it comes back to you. And the quality does flip up and down as your net connection gets better and worse. Sometimes it looks like YouTube, sometimes it looks a lot better, you know?
I mean, I think I can understand the concept of using your device as a terminal, and I can see how something like a netbook that's got limited graphics and stuff like that would work. You know, that could be quite a useful thing. It'd be interesting to see how it works. I mean, a few years ago, we worked on developing a project called Lydius, which was the Linux diskless internet access system. And that used X as a protocol over a 10 megabit network. And you could play videos and video games and so on and so forth, using the very same strategy. But the bandwidth was much better managed because it was a local area network, and obviously you could introduce quality of service and so on and so forth. Mm. My concern about anything like this really is how do you, you know, how do you cope with the inherent kind of lack of robustness that you've got with varying different network levels and so on and so forth. So it'd be, maybe we should take a look and see kind of what it looks like, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've played a few games. I mean, I played a little bit of Deus Ex, the first one, and I played through quite a lot of Fear 2, and then I also gave Dirt 3 a try. And my first experience was, I mean, background information, the internet here is appalling.
Right.
So it goes through peaks and troughs. Sometimes we get our, you know, I can click on a link and we're downloading it at 1.4 megabytes a second. It's like, aha, brilliant. And other times I can't watch YouTube. So when I first loaded it, I was obviously in one of those troughs. And it just said, your bandwidth is insufficient, goodbye. Obviously, that I could see that being a problem. If it was launch day and the game had just come out and I'd spent my dollars on it, or my pounds, and I wanted to play it, and then my net connection was playing up, then I'm stuffed. That wouldn't make me too happy. But then the second and third times when I was playing with it, it was a reasonably pleasant experience. You get the sort of feeling like you're playing online, like when you play a multiplayer game online, there's that lag.
Mm.
You get that feeling, but obviously even when you're playing a single player game, because it's still going through the network. But it was okay. You know, if you didn't have, I mean, I'm coming at this from a perspective of, I always have a PC, you know, the £700 PC that isn't top of the range, but it's good enough to play any game, then obviously it's a substandard experience for me, but it's not targeted at me because I have that PC and I buy the games.
So you think this is targeted at somebody with like a low-end PC who wants to get into games but isn't going to spend like a bunch of money on like on a big rig kind of thing?
I think in some ways it depends on where your expectations are set. I mean, we had a look at Dirt 3 just back along, and I don't play a great deal of video games anyway, and I have to say, given the inherent problems that I could foresee in trying to deliver a service like that with the amount of bandwidth that you've got available and the fact that you've got streaming video, actually it's very impressive, you know, the real-time graphics that it delivers. And you know, I mean, for example, my gaming console is a Wii, so you can imagine that the graphics, the level of graphics that I'm used to seeing, that to my eye looked pretty good. Like, you know, I mean, Dirt 3 looked great, and it seemed to work all right, and you know, and it was definitely a playable game, and certainly easily, I would say, up to the kind of stuff that I might have played on the PlayStation 2.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of level. Is it up to the latest PC stuff with the, you know, fast NVIDIA graphics card? Well, no, it isn't. But having said that, there's a huge amount of stuff on there and a lot of stuff to play. So I think it depends on where you're coming at it from. I mean, whilst you were talking there, I was just having a look because I was concerned about the technology behind it and having a look on some of the forums. And there's a few people talking about on live there and coming from the perspective of high quality graphics, like you say, and really, really poo-pooing the idea. I'm very impressed. Having worked on development projects to build this kind of technology to, I mean, you talked about it might be the kind of thing you put in a hotel room. Well, we, the Lydia system was built for that. We were delivering games over the local network and so on and so forth. And On Live is delivering actually better and higher performance, I think, than we were getting out of the Lydia's project over a flakier network. So they've put quite a lot of work into making that work quite well. There's some clever tech going on there, John.
I guess I could see the... And while there are quite a few benefits, yeah, again, the graphics for me are a bit of a stickler, but two of the really big benefits, I guess, is there's no installation process.
Yeah.
So that you just click on the game you want, and then you're playing it. You don't have to get the disc home and install it for 20 minutes and then hope your hardware works with the game and all that sort of rubbish, because every game on there will work because it's just going through this thin client.
Yeah, you're never going to have a problem with compatibility or anything like that. I guess my concern with it as a business model, just to take the flip side, is that I hope it's not an idea that gains too much traction and becomes too ubiquitous. I see it as like taking... Because as you know, I'm old, so I don't. So I trust nothing.
Where does that leave me?
And I guess my concern with something like this, if it became too popular or became the norm, is that it'd take more control out of the user's pocket. And because if they've got it all on their side, they can. I see similar stuff with Sony and their PS3. They've been notorious for like removing aspects of the firmware after you've bought the product. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay, yeah.
And if you're paying this, monthly fee, I guess I worry about it becoming like a treadmill, if you know what I mean, which they can wear down or file down as they see fit. Basically, the control's out of your hands because you don't own it anymore. You know what I mean? I guess that's my only concern with a model like that becoming the norm. In itself, it's a fantastic idea and it's done really well with it, but I hope, it sounds mean, but I hope it doesn't catch on, do you know what I mean?
Like too much.
Yeah.
See, exactly. I've got the flip side argument on the monthly rental. I think what I dislike about it is that you pay $40, $50 to purchase a game, but you never get it. You know, you just enable access to it through online. I'm like, well, I don't want to pay a big chunk of money for that. But I think the subscription model, where you pay just $10 a month and you get unlimited access to this core of 100 games, which is constantly going to be growing, I think that's really cool. That's the bit that I might be tempted by. So I don't have to buy all those games to play them for a week, never to touch them again. You know, if each one of those lasts me a week, that's 2 years of games, you know?
Which is a good deal when you paint it like that, actually. That's a good deal for the customer, isn't it?
Because I'll get through, you know. A lot of these games I might only play for a few hours because some of them are really old, some of them are a little bit old, some of them I wouldn't ever buy because I don't want to spend £20 in a shop on something like I don't know. I'm not a massive fan of racing games. I'll play the one that's big at the moment, but none others. But some of them I might like, but I never buy them.
I guess that's another concern for me. If this sort of thing became more popular, is that it would encourage a trend to developing games that you play for a few hours and then forget about. Like again on this $10 treadmill, so they're like a bit more disposable. And I hope that I'm probably bordering on superstitious with this stuff, but
I'm pretty sure the service wouldn't replace playing games in the lounge. You know what I mean? Like, wouldn't replace the actual gaming console.
No, sure.
That doesn't need a network connection.
It's the model more than OnLive, really, that my concerns with. I mean, OnLive itself looks like a catering to a very specific market of like people, as you say, that don't have a big rig, aren't going to get one, but want to just dip in, play games, and dip out. So you're going to get like a very selection of games on there. You're not going to get all of the games on there because they're not all going to be suited. So yeah, no, I think I'm probably being alarmist, and it will probably fill a slot, you know.
There are some interesting technological advantages then. It takes me back to a game I used to play called SOCOM on PlayStation 2, running around with a bunch of other guys who were all in different locations. So the multiplayer idea, and thinking about that experience whereby often the person that had the best internet connection with the best ping time would be the person that would win, because they'd get the graphics and see you first before you saw you and could shoot you before you even knew they were there. This kind of thing happened.
Whereas the ping king.
Yeah, the ping king. But if you're all playing on the same server, then you've got an equal playing field, and you're only distributing out then the screen that you're seeing. So does that change that dynamic a little bit?
I personally think it might even exacerbate the problem, because if you've got a slower connection, the imagery is going to be getting to you slower, but also your input is going to be getting to the server slower. So if you've got a worse connection, there's more going down it. Whereas with when you're playing with it all offline, all the assets are stored offline, so all that's actually going back and forth is the positions of the models. Now, if that gets a bit slow, granted you're a tenth of a second behind, but if you're forcing video down there, that doesn't leave too much bandwidth for your input to go back up.
But does that mean that when you do get lag, though, that your video will just jump frames? I mean, obviously, your input going back is a bit of an issue. I don't know. It's hard to say, really. I think probably have to try it and see. You might have a point there. But I've often wondered for a while about, the idea of massively multiplayer online games. Things like, if you look at the popularity of Second Life and things like that.
World of Warcraft, obviously.
Yeah. World of Warcraft is another classic, isn't it? I've looked at World of Warcraft. It doesn't really do anything for me at all. It's not kind of interactive and animate enough. I like things that are more like real-time 3D simulations, really. So Dirt 3, for example, when I saw that, I was immediately going, oh, yeah, I want to play that, because that's right in my bag, racing games. And I've often wondered about things like rally championships or circuit racing and stuff like that, where, something like that could be offered through online, where you could actually enrol to their service and then join join the ranks and so on and so forth, and do almost do like a real racing career and that kind of, or a real kind of game dev career, but on their servers playing against people. So I think it's got some really interesting ideas. The technology is just really, really early, isn't it? I think as our internet connections get better, and as the technology for compression and the reliability of the internet gets better, I think that the cloud, it's another cloud idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
Cloud gaming, if you like. I think it's got strong possibilities. Big technological hurdles.
Yeah, I mean, I guess last major point on it is, I think the place it would really shine is in the living room. So if you don't have a PC, maybe you've got an Xbox, but you're not dishing out loads of money for the latest games every month. If you're not a massive gamer, I don't know what the range is like on live. I don't know if it would appeal to kids. Obviously, it would have kids of a certain age, but you could just pay the $10 a month subscription, and then the kids could play whatever they wanted without any hassle of having to get a disc. I'm bored of this one now. Can we go to the shop and get another one? No need, just select the one you want off that list of 100 games.
And that's what kids are like, isn't it? they change their minds all the time, don't they?
There's a little set-top box with a couple of controllers dangling off the television. That could be pretty cool,
Well, obviously, I mean, as long as it's supported on Linux, I'm willing to give it a try. From digging around, it looks like it can be made to run under Wine on Linux, and I think that the company is developing a native version, but somebody's got it running under Wine, so I might be tempted to see if we can get that going on Ubuntu and have a tickle around with it.
Either way, it's going to happen by the sound of it, whether officially or unofficially.
I mean, what's quite cool is you can, with a free account, you can play every game on there for up to half an hour. It's like a trial period, so you can give the technology a try, even if you don't want to pay any money.
That's pretty good.
And I guess my last thought on the topic then is, when will there be an HTML5 client for it? one day it will just run in the browser. You just go to the URL, and there you go. Here's your games.
Well, there's me sitting there thinking, oh, John, that's a bit ambitious, but I would have said that about Quake as well. And we saw that running in the browser.
So that's on live. If you want to find out more, then go to our show site, www.atrandom.org, or check out onlive.com, and you can download the client for free and have a play of some of the games. I mean, just play some of the trials and see what you think. And if you have a good or bad experience, we'd love to hear back from you.
All Right, so next up, we've actually got a bit of a new addition to the show, a little shake-up of the format. Continuing on in the theme of Google Plus that we've been falling over ourselves with recently, this is going to be a section where we basically plus one interesting stuff, usually a website that we've seen on the net. And to kick off, I found this lovely little thing for... It's unashamedly for geeks, this thing. But anybody who's got an interest in science or science fiction, usually both, this thing's perfect. It's called Orbital Vector. Now, the site design is no great shakes, but do not let that put you off, because there is a wealth of really interesting content in here. Basically, what it is, it's all about... He says it best here when he says it's an online encyclopedia for the technology of the future. So as such, it deals with upcoming technology, cutting edge technology, but it's also quite speculative as to like technology of like the far future. So it mixes in a lot of talk of science fiction and how this stuff could actually be genuinely feasible. It talks about like how things like it's got whole sections in here about like tech levels of like. It's got arbitrary scales that, like, just for fun, it makes up like tech levels for different kinds of technologies. I mean, it says that us currently we're at tech level 10. I mean, this is completely arbitrary, made up by him, but it's quite useful for looking through the rest of the site when they talk about speculating on alien technologies and what categories they'd fit into. And they talk about things like gravity drives and star colonies and all kinds of like really it's quite advanced stuff. I mean, it's not mucking about with its language.
But, warp drive looks pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, they do talk about a few kinds of drives, like warp drives and gravity drives, but they've got things like more current, more attainable technologies. But it's interesting the way it puts it in context by talking about like examples in science fiction and saying, how far off it believes they would be. And again, it's all speculation, but it's all speculation about... It's serious speculation rather than somebody just spouting off about their favourite sci-fi show.
That's really cool.
It's got some links to some very interesting stuff like people have done the journey to Mars with like a little picture of Earth at the top, Mars at the bottom, but they've done it to scale. So you're sat there scrolling with your mouse for ages and ages, and halfway down you say, okay, I get it, Mars is a long way away. But they've got a few things like that which are quite... links to all kinds of stuff like that, which are just quite fun to look through.
Cool. That's Orbital Vector.
Orbital Vector,
great,
yeah.
Picture of a delta wing futuristic aircraft there.
Yeah.
So, awesome.
It's really interesting. Sort of thing I can kick back and sink an hour or two into at work.
More so. Very interesting stuff.
Cool. Orbitalvector.
Orbital Vector. I will just bring up the thing. It is orbitalvector.com.
Fantastic.
Awesome.
Cool. Well, I'm keeping in with the gaming theme today after talking about OnLive. And when I was growing up, I played a lot of cool games at friends' houses and never really had them myself. You know, you have a few and you played more at friends' houses. And then I got a bit older and I got to university and there were all these copies of old games going around the network. And that was quite cool because you could play them. But quite often they would come as kind of 78 1 megabyte zip files because someone made it for floppy disk, and they're a pain to install. And then a couple of months ago, I found GOG.com, Good Old Games.
Good Old Games, okay.
And what it is all the stuff that you would probably used to classify as abandonware, which is what you called it when you tried to justify downloading these games illegally. Thinking, oh, I'm sure it's all right, they've been abandoned. I'll call them abandonware and just find a download. But essentially, this site sells games, you know, ranging from kind of 3 or 4 years back, right back to 15 years back, sort of right from the early days of the PC. So, I mean, if we look on the front page here, there's some classics like Planescape Tournament, Dungeon Keeper 2, Wing Commanders 1 and 2.
Awesome, Wing Commander. I love that.
And anyone that's been playing games for more than 5 to 10 years, this site is definitely worth having a look at. I mean, I loved Dungeon Keeper when I was growing up. That was absolutely amazing. And the reason why I found this site was I was actually looking for a game called Conflict Free Space, which is a space flighting sim, which is really cool as well. And the games on here range from $5 to $10, basically. I don't think there's any games on there for more than $10, apart from one recent game, which... It's really weird. For some reason, they've got Witcher 2 on there, which came out a few months ago. So it's not really a classic game, but absolutely every other game on there ranges usually between $6 and $10. But they're DRM free, so you can just download the .exe file and then just install it on your Windows PCs, and there's no faff with it or anything. You just literally download like a 600 meg .exe file, double click on it, and then you're playing it.
So no fuss, you buy it.
That's good.
And I think they've done some tweaks to make sure they work, because a lot of these games, if you just installed it from the original CDs, wouldn't work anymore.
Okay.
So they've patched the binaries or whatever to make sure they work on modern computers and don't run at 1,000 frames a second without being limited and things, you know, because some old games would just run really fast on modern computers. So they've, all the games on here will work on your PC. They shouldn't have any faff in trying to get them to work. So
streamlined, retro, faff free.
Be interesting to try and see if they can get some of those good old games down and run them under Wine on Linux. See whether some of them would fire up.
I'd imagine that most of them will, because they're
quite cool.
But I mean, yeah, that's GOG.com, and it's definitely worth a trip down memory lane if you've been playing games for more than 5 years, I guess.
GOG.com. I've got something very simple and straightforward, but I think it's also uber awesome, and it's definitely worth taking a look at. The website is www.paulrhayes.com. He's a UK-based web designer. And he's got a page up there which is under the experiments directory, cube-3D, and you can find the URL in the show notes. But basically what it is a HTML5 CSS3 cube in three dimensions. So you can basically just, here I'm doing it on the iPad, so you can just, you would use your mouse on your screen, but basically you can rotate the cube in three dimensions. It's got different bits of information on either face, telling you a little bit about what Paul does and so on and so forth. It just says here, 28th of September, a 3D cube built using CSS and the WebKit perspective, transform and transition CSS attributes. And very straightforward and simple in its operation, nothing really super funky about it, but it also gives you information about figuring out how it works. There's documentation to show you how to learn how it works. You can take a look at the CSS and the JavaScript. All the code is there available. And in my investigations into HTML5 and CSS3 for this seg that's coming up, I discovered this and just thought, actually, that has got some really, really cool ideas in there, and it's definitely worth a look at, particularly because it's so well documented.
I think what's really nice is the way that the grunt work is only done by CSS.
Mm.
You know, obviously, like, the input interaction is a little bit of JavaScript, I guess, but
essentially, it's just CSS, isn't it?
The application of the perspective, you know, the bit that is mathematically the hard work, if you were doing it by hand, is actually done by CSS. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so, there it is, paulrhayes.com. Definitely worth 5 minutes of your time just to have a look at that for the awesomeness of it.
Even on an iPad.
Even on an iPad, yeah. The next segment that we've got up is the introduction of the Magnitune tracks. We wanted to take a look at Magnitune, and we talked about that in the last show, so we've been choosing out some tracks. So for this episode, we have got a band called Nova Express. This track is available on Magnitune, and it's called Gimme Some More. We'll be right back. So, okay, if you remember from show 7, we had Chris on from the Dennis Group, and he was telling us about Padda. And so I went off and got the app and had a look at it, and I've had a chance to have a play around with it and have a look at it. And I've brought some of the early versions for us to look at, and I've also downloaded the latest version as well, so which is still got a wrapper on, guys. So we'll have a look at that in a minute. But basically, Chris came on and told us about this, the concept of Padda, which basically just takes the idea, I think, really, of moving a magazine across onto the iPad, but really developing the whole thing around the medium. So instead of trying to think about a paper magazine and then transferring it to the iPad, actually just thinking about how should a magazine be on this kind of device.
Sure.
So these guys have sort of pulled Padda together. And basically, it's I found it quite cool, and it's kind of funky in a sort of Apple kind of way. Although I'm a bit worried about the level of content that there is on each issue. But you can see here, basically, you've got like the index, which is navigatable here on the right hand side, so you can flick through the different things.
Oh, yeah.
And look at the different pages and jump backwards and forwards and so on and so forth, which, you know, so it's a bit kind of like a website-y feel in some ways.
Yeah.
But then you've got this distinctly magazine sort of editorial type style. So here's Chris's editorial on this first issue, and you can see, you know, it's kind of pretty much like the sort of thing you would expect from a magazine. But then you can you can start to flick around and you know, scroll backwards and forwards like this. You've got kind of the flexibility to sort of wander around the application as well, looking at different things. And then they've got the opportunity to interact with different things, so you can put interactive adverts and so on and so forth. And it reminds me a little bit like if you remember way back when I talked about the Times advert,
that
newspaper, and I thought the Times had really got that right, and it was working very well, and I still use the Times today. I think Padda has got that right to a degree in the way that the magazine works. I like the style and the feel of it and so on and so forth. My concern really is the content a little bit. But
how do you mean you're concerned with the content? Do you mean like the nature of the content or the amount of it?
Yeah, I think the quantity of content is, you know, the each issue is 149, and you know, it feels like it's a little bit content light sometimes. And certainly, and it feels a bit kind of a little bit ad heavy in areas. You know, I mean, I'm looking at this thing here, for example, and I mean, this is a rock. It's called the Rockform Stand, which is an iPad stand, and you know, it looks like a piece of space age engineering. And
it looks like the front of a bulldozer.
Yeah, I mean, this thing is obviously designed to look kind of super cool, but you can. Yeah, well, as you just did there, John, you can flick through the different colours, which change on the... It's obviously swapping the image around, so you've got, like, 6 different colours here. That is absolutely gorgeous. Look at that.
A pink one.
A pink...
Bright pink.
A pink Android-looking robot iPad stand, which, you know, at $169 for the stand, I'd probably take 2. So, you know, there's, you know, and this, of course, is taking the whole of a content page. Now, yeah. It's been kind of done in that very kind of chic, I wear grey slacks and drive a Porsche, work on the stock market kind of, and I buy Apple and I buy Rolex and so on and so forth, you know. So there's that kind of feel to it.
So you'll put off like some of the crowd, the Apple hating crowd. They're not going to be converted by something like this, basically.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but having said that, some of the articles that are in there are quite nice. They've got this section here which is done regularly about the App Store. So, and of course, the whole point of this Padda thing is it's designed to talk specifically around the iPad. So, so the gadgets that you're looking at there are all related to the iPad. This App Store stuff is all about iPad apps, and the content throughout is all about the iPad. So in terms of, if you want to kind of have a sort of really branded designer-led kind of content experience and get right into your iPad, then Padda seems to work for that. So,
yeah.
And, you know, showing off some different things here, talking about GarageBand and
It's all wonderfully presented, isn't it? As you, I think as a
beautiful, yeah,
as a model for like other magazines like it, I think it really shows you what's possible with all the interactive content and stuff. I mean, the content, yeah, as you say, might not be everybody's bag, but I think it really shows off the potential.
Yeah, what I really like is the we did briefly mention this in the interview last week, is that the pages no longer feel like they're constrained to being on a piece of A4 paper. Mm. They just go on as long as they need to, like a web page, but it feels more, it does look more like a print magazine than a web page, doesn't it? So it's like a hybrid of the two. It's got the nice interactive features. You click on the bits that are obviously interactable, if that's a word, to change the pictures above them and below them. But at the same time, it fits the iPad very well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think if you were... like I say, my concern was a little bit, my concern really is about the content and whether there's enough content there to really engage with people. Mm. And at 149 a go, that's my only concern. In terms of, have they got understood the idea of delivering an iPad magazine that would work the way you would anticipate the technology to? I think they've got that absolutely spot on. Yeah. You know, they've really got that right, for sure. And what I did say was that, you know, we would take a look at the latest issue.
Yeah, I read the first two issues that were on there. I think the first issue is actually free, isn't it? So so you can download the app and have a look at it and see what it's like. But like you say, my only gripe so far is that the content is a bit light on the ground. And like you say, while it's not all adverts, they're all about products, which feel like adverts.
Yeah, it's kind of like a more for me, in a more easily digestible way to advertise to me. Because, hey, I might actually be interested, you know?
So this that we're looking at here is the latest version. And I quite like the way that the cover opens up here, because as you opened it up, basically, it just sort of takes you around some of the key content aspects. There's four people here with iPads, and it's just going around with a little animation and showing you what the kind of magazine's contents are.
Yeah, quite light, actually. It's all that pixel art, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the ZX Spectrum a little bit in the way that the graphics have been done there.
The Spectrum wishes it had that many colours.
And then let's just see what happens if we just treat this like a magazine on the iPad, and I'm just going to have a flick through it, just like I would if I was just picking this up. And I've not seen this before, so I like this. This is a nice little... This leather case looks really quite cool. And so you can flip this open, and they've got a nice ad for a really nice bound leather case here, which looks really great.
Yeah, it's kind of an ad / review, isn't it? I mean, to us it's an advert, but I think to the... It's also... You get these in magazines, like in...
Yeah, it is. Yeah, except that the difference is in a magazine that would just be one picture with bang, you know, with a little bit of what they're saying. Whereas here, you know, we've got these four icons that we can touch, and we can, you know, flip through the different kind of imagery, etc., and then take a flip here. So there's a chair that is a red. I'm not quite sure how that goes with iPad here.
It's an iPad chair.
It's the one to sit in when you
it's use an iPad chair with a table.
To be fair, the table does look like a big iPad.
I don't know kind of what to make of that.
It's like a big iPad on a pole.
maybe. Okay. So they're talking about retro furniture. What's this then? A stylus for the iPad. Now, I've been wondering about one of those for a while. Wacom Bamboo stylus. Ooh, I might have to look at that. That looks quite cool.
Good stuff, yeah.
My current experience with the iPad styluses? Pretty appalling.
Are they?
Yeah, you've got to... They're just like big... Well, they're like little bean bags, and you have to rub them across the screen like little rubber bean bags, because they can't have a point on them because of the nature of the touchscreen.
Ah, right, okay, so that's going to be... Oh, right.
The only real reason you want a stylus is for the accuracy, which you completely lose when it's the size of, like, a marble, you know?
Yeah. Oh, well, maybe that's maybe not worth $24.99.
Shut down.
So some apps looking here, I'm kind of drawn by the alarm clock, but that maybe just kind of shows you my level of kind of tech ability, which is I want to turn my iPad into an £800 alarm clock.
It's a digital alarm clock.
Well, it is, yeah. And well, that looks quite cool. So there's some, you know, interesting stuff. This is kind of grabbing me as I'm flicking through it. I'm thinking, ooh, I'm looking at this. Wow, that looks good. Planetary, some sort of astronomical thing. So this is like looking at some apps. Advert for the Times, well, I've already got that. And then 30 apps for kids. And so, you know, you can kind of...
I mean, let's face it.
Stands.
This is more like advertising, but done right.
Yeah. I mean,
for starters, it's targeted at the target audience who wants to read it. They're gonna read it for this purpose.
Yeah.
And they get information on the products delivered to them in an informative fashion with no bull surrounding it. No, I think this is. I mean, yeah, no question. This is advertising, but it's. I think it's miserly to dismiss it as advertising because if you are dismissive of it, then you're obviously not the target audience. If you're interested in what Apple products are available, it's a lovely way to see what's available.
I think that sums it up really well, actually, Jack. What you've said there, you know, yeah, it's giving you information and adverts specifically around the iPad. It's certainly got a kind of. Oh, I didn't know that, and oh, wow, that's interesting. And it's, you know, it's a kind of, you know, on the train, on the bus, whatever kind of thing. I've got a few minutes and I want to have a flick through some stuff. And it's, it's almost got a randomness to it as well. I mean, what the hell's that? Two yellow helicopters are flying over the White Horse.
I do want to add that I think this issue is showing a little bit more content, which I'm glad to see. Like, it's got that tutorial about using iMovie.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of articles from the other members of the team, and then the how to get the most out of your iPad. I did feel like
there was a tutorial on GarageBand in number two as well. But yeah, I mean, there certainly seems to be a little bit more, some more graphical stuff going on and bits and pieces. So yeah, you know, it is filling out a bit, isn't it? So
unfortunately for me, I don't think there's enough content to warrant the $149 per copy price tag.
Mm. I tend to agree with you, John. I think that's a bit steep, really.
But only if it was 69, you know, the 69p, I think I'd get it just for the app listings and things. You know, like, here's 30 cool apps. That's quite nice to read, but at the heart, it does feel a bit like an advertorial, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And if there are a few more tutorials and articles in there, the $150 price point would be fine, but I think it's just a bit overpriced for what's in it at the moment.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think they've got a lot right, but that price point is wrong. I think that, and I'm not even sure that I think 49 pence is probably about right, really, for what's in there. Given the fact that I think that the level of advertisement for products in there, then this really ought to be being ad supported if it's being done in that way. So.
But that's Padder.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, definitely. I mean, go onto the App Store and download it and have a look. You know, the first version is free of charge. You can take a look and see what you think, and it's definitely worth taking a look at, just for the experience of seeing where it's going to lead. Because I think we'll see a lot more stuff like this.
Yeah.
As we go forward in the future.
Cool. Yeah. Definitely worth trying out. So, what have you brought? This show, Jack?
It's another game.
Hey!
I know you people love games. You might not like the ones I pick, though. But let's see if I can show you this one that I've got here called Airport Terminal. Now, this is a fun little thing that, in my mind, it quite well sums the pressures and the logistics. It's basically deals with the logistics of getting people on a plane and seeing to their needs, because you haven't just got to get them on a plane, you got to make them happy. Best way I can describe it is a resource management game. And the graphical style has got elements of Angry Birds in terms of the presentation. But once you get into it, it's more like something like Game Dev Story, if anybody's familiar with that. But the mechanics are actually, the best thing I can compare it to is The Sims. There's a lot of influence going on here, but I think The Sims is probably the biggest one. As we can see here, yeah, it's all heavy on the colour and presentation, very attractive looking game. And if I tap on Departure...
She looks like she's from Eurovision. That person on the front.
She actually looks a bit like Cammy off of Street Fighter. I'm hoping that doesn't reflect in the gameplay here. And right away we have the world map, and as with most games, you've got to unlock them a bit at a time. So if we start our first level, United States. And here we go, when that loads up. And this is going to bring up bring up the airport for the United States. I mean, I assume every location brings up a different airport. I've not got far enough through the game to see it yet. But basically what you have to do is your passengers will come in, one, two at a time, the numbers increase as the game goes on, and each of them has stages that they go through at the airport. You have to get them from one stage to the next, and this will vary depending on what they want at any one time. So if we tap continue, we can see the this is the airport terminal, and here we can see all like, the ticket offices and stuff. And this is, if we go through the tutorial here, this is a good way to demonstrate the way it works. And here come off two passengers with little cartoon characters coming in. And yeah, here he says here, the first passenger ready to check in. If we tap the passenger to select him, and there we are, we've got him. And I've got to, he's a business class passenger, so I have to get him to the right booth. So he goes to the booth, and here we are. Then there's various, he's got like a satisfaction meter, which is like the little hearts by his head. And then we have to check him in, and he's got some headphones, and we have to put that into the right category for what he's carrying, which is music. And we just tap OK. Big hearts come up. That means you've done a good job. And he's got a little... this is where it gets a bit like The Sims. Above his head, he's got like the cafe, which means he's hungry. So I've got to take him and take him to the restaurant. So now he's fine. For a bit, anyway. He can only stay there for so long. This is where it gets confusing, because you've got to remember you've got other passengers who need dealing with, and you've got other ones who might be doing something else, and they've got to be dealt with as well. This woman's poor, so she's going in economy. Take her to economy, and she's got the same deal. She doesn't have any luggage. So there's different rules for different classes. There's a lot to remember by the look of it. The first thing that struck me was it was a little bit complicated, but if you're up for... it's a resource management game. If that's your bag, then this is a really well-presented one. I particularly like... well, the aspects that are like The Sims. I like it when the little thought bubbles appear above their head and say, washroom, or... see, here we go, this guy here. If we go to... she wants to go to the restaurant. I take her to the restaurant. But she can't go to the restaurant because he's at the restaurant right away. You start getting a feel for how busy this game is going to get later on. Now I've got to get this guy away from the restaurant so she can go in there. I take him to the washroom. And he goes in there and he's taken care of. And you basically have to get them from one area to the next while keeping them all happy. With two people, this is doable. I suspect this won't be so easy with, like, 10 or 15.
No, I think not. I think the graphics are really good in it.
They are.
And just, I'm just taking a wild hit here. Is it made by the same company that makes Angry Birds?
I thought so at first, but I think that was more because I saw some similar fonts and icons. I mean, I don't think it's the... I don't believe it's the same company, although I could be wrong.
I got that feel. The graphics gave me that kind of feel.
I don't think it is. My wife plays a lot of games, actually, and I would like to say they're similar to that, but I'll go a bit further and say they're identical with different graphics. There's a hairdresser one, there's a restaurant one, and they're all... yeah. Essentially the same game, but they have to go to different points on the screen.
Yeah, it's very much like a cut down version of that, like one of those sim airport games, isn't it?
Mm.
But stripped right down for an iPhone and simplified.
But it goes down very well. I think they're it's almost a genre, you know, and
it is.
It's emerging in the casual gaming world, and it's popular and it's fun.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this one's certainly fun. The presentation, I cannot fault. Absolutely, it's a really lovely little graphics they got for it.
It is. It's really, yeah, that's what I would say. I mean, I have to say, for me, that type of game, I didn't really quite understand it.
Yeah.
So that shows that maybe I'm not very good at resource management at all.
There's a lot going on. I mean, we could talk about like it in stages each time, but it would use up too much time. But for me to just motor through it is a lot to take in all in one shot.
But I love the look of it. The look and feel of it and the graphics, I think, are really good. And it reminds me a little bit of a mix between Angry Birds and the Bratz comics that my daughter's quite into, you know. So,
yes, definitely. All the big heads and stuff.
Yeah. Mm.
But that's Airport Terminal. And believe it or not, that's free as a bird.
Ah.
You won't have to pay a thing for it.
Like free.
Fantastic. I've got something a little bit different to bring to the table in this show.
Okay.
I know we usually do mobile apps, but I mean, we've always had the intention of doing whatever we've been using at the time. And I wanted to bring you a development environment that I use on OS X. I've been using it for a few months now, and it's called Coda. Coda.
Okay.
And it's made by a company called Panic Software, and they've done a small collection of Mac applications. And I guess this is, for me, the big one they've done. They've done a few other, like, change your screen icons and things. It's reasonably hard to put down on paper what is so good about it, but the design is really straightforward. So you have one tab here that has all your sites, and now for each site you essentially set up the local details, so you can set up the sort of root directory for that site and the URL that you'll be using to test it locally. But then you can also put in the remote location of the site and the remote URL.
Okay.
So while you're editing the site, what's quite nice is it memorizes all of the tabs you've got open for that site. So, you know, this kind of workspace is memorized. So if I go away and come back tomorrow and work on a different site, it will have the documents I had open last week on that site.
All right.
It's got an inbuilt preview option. Now, I'm not running the whole sort of suite at the moment, so you can't really see it. But I mean, that's essentially a little window, and you can open it up in a web browser as well. It's got a nice CSS editor, so if you load a CSS file in, then you can change nearly all the CSS options without having to actually go and type them.
That looks quite groovy.
And I mean, I don't really use it because I'm a bit too geeky for that, but I can see how you might use this. So, for instance, let's see if I can find you. I'm going to try and find a CSS file. Let's make one, shall we?
Make one.
But yeah, you can generate your own styles and classes by using the CSS editor.
I think it's important to point out here that if anybody's sort of thinking, when they hear this and think about code, or they start thinking about an IDE type environment, it isn't anywhere near as complicated as that at all.
No.
It's very clean, a little bit more like sort of a fairly sophisticated notepad with a file browser on the left hand side, and I quite like that, to be honest with you, because very often IDEs kind of overcomplicate things. They can have a huge amount of complexity, which can be intimidating for new users.
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably peg it as a text editor plus. You know, it's more closer to a text editor than a full on IDE. But here, so you can generate your kind of CSS, but using their nice clickable buttons as opposed to having to worry about doing it yourself. And then you can switch back to the preview tab and see how it works. There's also a terminal, so if you put in the correct details for your site, you can just log straight in. And
I know I'm changing settings for a while, but
but that terminal will stay open for your session, so you can.
Can it do FTP or SFTP, any of that kind of stuff?
So for the actual file transfer, it can use FTP or SSH.
Okay.
SCP.
That's useful.
And then you can also load your books in here, so it can keep your books on the right pages.
So, it's nice that it consolidates several different apps that are always working in conjunction with each other and then just puts them all in one application.
Mm.
I like that. I like the fact that, you know, you've got your books and documentation are there. I like that this, I mean, like you, the CSS side of things, to be fair, I probably prefer to craft the CSS in a text editor.
Yeah.
But I like the fact that you could play around with that tool quite a lot to see what different things do and get an idea of what's the syntax for this, that and the other. You know what I mean? It could be helpful as a learning tool, and also to play around and experiment is good.
And it opens up some of these less common options, like the shadows, drop shadows.
Mm.
You know, you can sort of go, oh, I hadn't thought of that. I didn't realise that was in CSS.
Yeah, the stuff nobody touches, yeah.
Yeah.
So it does open up all of the CSS options to you. But I mean, it's got code highlighting, like you'd expect from a tool like this, obviously.
Yeah.
But what I find most useful, excuse me, on the tabs here, you can view your local file system or the remote one, and you can just switch between them and open files on either. But whenever you save a file, it marks it as unpublished.
Okay.
And then,
so you don't get confused, yeah.
If I want to send this single file to the server, I can just click on there. But at the end of an editing session, I can test it and go, right, I'm happy with that. Publish. At that point, it just uploads all the files that have changed today to the server, or since the last time I hit publish.
That's clever. I like that. That's useful.
So, I mean, I would I wouldn't really use this to publish to a live site. But what I tend to do is I have the local version, which is really hacky, obviously. It breaks every few minutes while I'm coding on it. And at the end of the day, when I'm happy, and that's something that I want to then upload to the public client testing site, where the client can test it, I just whack publish, and all the files I've changed go straight up to the server.
Mm.
So, and it you know, probably takes 15 minutes out of the day for me every time. And you can search through your files. So you can search through all the files in a project by clicking up here and doing something. So you can see all of the projects that are, all of the files in your project that are using a certain class, say. That's a bad example because I've done it in the wrong search box.
But in theory, they can't. So we could just as well pretend, oh, yeah, it worked perfectly.
This is the one. This is where it belongs. So. And there you go. It searches through the whole project and then brings it up on the side. Nice. To see all the files that are referenced in that class, say.
So I think if you started your career as a web designer with FrontPage and then moved on to Dreamweaver, this is not a tool for you.
No.
But if you started with Nano or Notepad, then I think this is an awesome tool because it's really well organised and well structured without being cluttered. Is it only available for OS X?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Okay.
It is about £60. Right. Which is obviously quite a lot of money for what it is.
I don't know, this is a serious piece of kit. I mean professionals are going to be using this thing, aren't they?
Mm.
So I don't think that's an unreasonable price for something you're going to be using for what is going to be professional use.
I mean, you know, like I say, it probably cuts 15 minutes off every day for me, but that means it very quickly earns its money.
Mm.
It's very quickly earned its value back if you consider those 15 minutes every day, an hour Absolutely. A week, half a day a month, you know.
Yeah,
pay for itself in a couple of weeks then. So, but no, I really like that, and that's Coda, CODA, and you can get a link to that on our website. So.
At random. Hey, hiya lads, it's Jerry Mank Techie coming back at ya. Now, I've got an interesting one for you, a bit of a question for you this week, lads. Yeah. I've been watching this stuff on YouTube, and I tell you what, there's some stuff on there, mate, that totally does your melanin. It's mad as a box of frogs. I was watching this stuff about environment and different things, and it's funny how environmental topics are always linked to conspiracy theories, but I wanted to have something for you guys to have a debate about. We were looking for cheap and friendly PCs, you know, ARM architectures and low-power PCs that can be utilised to reduce the cost of running data centres. And whilst they were doing that, I came across, there seemed to be, wherever you go, like, there always seemed to be conspiracy theory films on YouTube. And all a bit kind of mad, really. Anyway, I started having a look at this one, and it totally twisted me melon, man, because basically what they were saying was that European Times, this newspaper, had been reporting on a story that were being broken by WikiLeaks about a notification to Russian President or Russian Prime Minister or something like that. Anyway, we're totally mental, this story. And what we're saying were that that UFOs had been coming out at Southern Ocean, and the Americans had got into a conflict with them, and they were trying to bat them off because UFOs were basically coming out of the Southern Ocean, flying around South America and Mexico, you know, frightening folks and scaring them and, you know, basically doing the Swedes in. Apart from top of that, when they were coming out of the ocean, they were causing these big waves which were causing problems with boats. You can see it for yourself, lads. Go and have a look on YouTube. Put WikiLeaks, UFOs, Southern Ocean into YouTube, and you'll find videos all about it. Anyway, I just wondered what you lads thought, something different to have a look at, you know, from a technical standpoint. But I just thought, you know, I wonder if UFOs, if people really, you know, if aliens actually live inside the planet. And maybe they've been using oil and gas for their technology. Maybe they keep it in sky and we've been drilling through ground and nicking it. And, of course, they've gone, what's going on up there? We're oil and gas is going missing. Oi, you, get out there and find out what's going on. So they've come out and have a look and seen us nicking it all. And so now they're not happy about it and they're having something to say. Anyway, let me know what you think about that, lads, and I'll catch you soon. Jerry, Mank Techie, out.
Oh, Jerry.
What?
Do you think he's on something?
I think he has to be on something. Well, he's definitely on YouTube.
Oh, tell you what, though. Might make for quite an interesting segment of the show. Look into all that crazy UFO stuff.
It definitely is crazy stuff. Sure, isn't
we'd
it?
Be yeah. forced to dismiss something that Jerry said out of hand, I think.
So, Jerry, the eternal advisor.
It's worth checking his facts.
Well, maybe it's worth a look on YouTube. Do you reckon we should do something on that?
Yeah, I reckon that'd be a bit of a laugh. Where it is at random, of course.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll have a look on YouTube and do a bit of research on Jerry's ideas. And
yeah, just make sure he didn't imagine the whole thing.
Yeah. He might be right. Might have something there, you know?
He probably is right.
We're all living on a Maltese.
suddenly reminded of the end of Men in Black. All the marbles. Anyway, brilliant. We'll do that. We'll definitely do that. Next show, something a bit different.
The truth is out there.
Fantastic. Okay, John, what have we got?
So, this is something which we kind of brushed on a few times, I think, over our shows up to this point. And we did actually talk about it in a kind of gaming sense right back at the beginning. But I thought it'd be worth having a proper chat about HTML5 and CSS3.
Hmm.
And primarily, you know, we talked about the Chrome App Store and how delivering apps through the browser. I thought it might be quite interesting to see how HTML5 could actually be used to develop applications,
hmm.
you know, full applications that we actually get to play with through a browser window. So.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, absolutely, okay. Well, I've got a question then, really, about HTML5 to start with. I mean, it seems to me that HTML5 is a generic term for three technologies being bundled together. HTML as a markup language, CSS for the styling, and JavaScript for any kind of client-side functionality. Have I got that broadly right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a... I don't really like the way that the term HTML5 is being used to encompass all three, but it seems to be. You know, because HTML5 obviously technically only really represents the markup language, which is then presented on the screen with the addition of CSS3, and people are saying, oh, HTML5 games. It's like, well, HTML5 part of it is just two tags, and that's a canvas tag.
Yeah.
And then it's turned into a game through JavaScript. So it's a bit of a kind of misnomer saying it's an HTML5 game, but that is the term that seems to be prevailing. So,
HTML5 is like the manager, and he's taking credit for his fighter kind of thing. Because he let you in to see him, and say, yeah, you come and see my fighter in action, but essentially he's just your gateway guy.
Now that was what I was getting as well. So it seemed to me that HTML5, I mean, all of these technologies seem to be, I mean, it's described as being almost like a point marker, as though there's some kind of large transition, but it isn't at all, actually. It's an evolution. And in the terms of HTML5, it looks to me like it's an evolution in undoing a whole bunch of mistakes that were written into HTML as a markup language to start with. It was, you know, there seemed to have been a whole bunch of things built into the HTML markup to enable it to do layout things and stuff like that, some of which were being, well, frankly, bastardized because tables, for example, were designed to lay out information. Because HTML was just for describing documents. But then very quickly the designers started to chop tables up and chop images up and so on and so forth and use the tool like that. So we've got this term, as you say, HTML5, which seems to be encompassing everything, but it isn't at all. In actual fact, the HTML5 element is as being more cut down and more restricted. But from what I've been looking and reading about it, I have to say I like HTML5 a great deal more than the previous incarnations of it. It's more clear what it's going to do, and it has, you know, just it's more elegant the way that it's been put together. And I think that that's helpful.
I think the important thing, for me, two important things about HTML5, ignoring the JavaScript and CSS elements at the moment, are, first of all, it is a markup language that now
does a better job of defining its content. So whereas before you wrap things in lots of divs with IDs to define different parts of your document, HTML5 seems far better suited to actually saying, well, look, here's a video tags. Mm. Here's some media tags. You know, like defining what it is as opposed to going, I want to put a video in here, which means I'm going to have to put a div in, and then loads and loads of flash, and that's an object, and an embedded thing, and, you know, it didn't really describe what was in it. It was just a way of hacking the browser to make it do what you wanted.
Mm.
And that brings me on to the second point, which I think is really useful about HTML5, is the way you can now embed videos. It's taken a modern look at the web. Instead of saying, oh, we're trying to make printed documents that you can view in a browser, it's gone, well, actually, this is what websites have on them now. They're all run by different bits of flash at the moment to push these FLV videos out. Let's just make that part of the browser. And then the browser can be optimized to do that better, as opposed to you relying on the host of the site to give you the right flash to do it better.
Mm.
So now it's your browser's concern how it's going to render that video, which means your browser can be upgraded to upscale that video better, and you're not stuck with the software that you're given by the site provider. So,
but that means by very method that we're having to put more development into the browsers, and we're seeing, of course, that there's this rapid upscaling in terms of the almost like a reignition of the browser wars, but even on a more rapid scale now, really, with the development of Chrome, Firefox, and IE, and they're all starting to run, and obviously WebKit-based stuff like Safari. Everybody's like iterating as they're building more and more of these things in. The bit that worries me about this is all of these things, like, well, we talked about the WebKit transforms for that cube, for example. They're WebKit-specific functions, and you've got Mozilla-specific functions, and so on and so forth. I'd like to see those kinds of things addressed from a CSS and a HTML perspective, so that we make sure we stay, you know, we've got an opportunity here to work towards standards and make things more compliant. And I think that, I'd like to see that done. I fear that it won't be, and we'll end up with divisions and separations as the various browser vendors try to fight each other.
I'm still the youthful optimist, so I think that the kind of branching has been a product, initially it was a product of the other browsers not wanting to implement it. So things like drop shadow and background gradients, to start with, only one or two browsers cared. So they didn't want to use standard CSS because other browsers didn't. So they were kind of making a point. It's like, oh, look, it's the WebKit gradient. Aha. Now I think they're coming in because of this rush to get all the features in. And everyone's like, oh, they're expecting drop shadows. Ah, we make it a WebKit thing. But I like to think over the coming months, all the browsers are going to want you to use these features more, and the only way that people are going to use them more is if they become a standard.
Mm.
So I'm actually quite hopeful that many of these features, like the drop shadows and the gradients and even the 3D transitions, I think they will become part of the CSS standard and will be implemented by standard by the browsers. Maybe in 12 months' time when it's all settled down a bit. But I think, especially with IE9 now actually supporting some of the better CSS tags, other browsers can actually afford to start using the standard tags.
Didn't take it long, did it?
12 years or...
And what about the JavaScript side of things, though, for a moment? Because JavaScript, I mean, in its early days, the very early days for JavaScript seemed to me to be sort of almost like a, it was peddled almost like as the fix thing. It was the thing that you used to kind of fix stuff that you just couldn't do in HTML and so on and so forth.
Polyfiller.
Yeah, exactly. You're filling the cracks with it and so on and so forth. And the language in itself was actually fairly incomplete. And of course, it's become, well, I think now it's probably fair to say that JavaScript is a fairly well-rounded, object-orientated language. I think I'd be prepared to stand up and say that I think it is. But it's got quite a checkered history with all sorts of security issues and all kinds of vulnerabilities. Now, of course, we're being peddled at the moment. We talk about JavaScript as a very positive thing, but it has got a huge number of negatives in the back that it come from as well. And of course, it opens up the more powerful you make it, the more risk you open up with security and stuff like that. Anybody got any comments on that side of things, the JavaScript side of things?
Yeah, I think I personally think JavaScript is a bit of a mess still. I mean, it's still, you know, obviously it has a lot of power there, but I mean, it's kind of prototyping type ideology that comes with it, but also the fact that basically you need to use jQuery if you want to get the same effect across all browsers still. I don't know if that's true of the really cutting edge work, but I know that writing JavaScript to work cross browser is still, I think it's still quite a bit of work unless you're using one of these libraries like jQuery, which kind of does a lot of the work for you.
I guess it's still the only real way to sort of like tie up this disparity between the different browsers, I suppose.
Yeah, because, you know, in certain areas they all have their own method calls for doing certain things, so you've got to wrap that in some library to make it generic, which then kind of limits you to what that library can do. But, I mean, what I thought was really interesting, and this is perhaps where I see some of the best kind of applications and games from this HTML5 JavaScript model coming from, is something where, like, Google have developed a system that lets you translate a Java program into JavaScript. So the Quake 2 demo that we looked at many months ago, that was actually taken from the Java build of Quake 2, which they ran through their translator to turn into JavaScript. And I think that's, if I were to build a fully fledged application, that is the route I would look to take, I think. Write it in a proper language, in quotes, like Java, make sure it works on the desktop, and then just run it through this translator and kind of pray a little bit that it works.
There's a bit that gets me terribly nervous there about what happens when you've gone to all that effort, you run it through and it comes out and it doesn't work. Do you end up with like some monstrous hunk of sausage machine code that is just completely just undoable? You can't fix it, you can't go in there, you can't do anything. I assume it isn't going to come out all nicely laid out and documented and all the rest of it for you, is it?
I'm pretty sure it does come out as just a pile, almost a JavaScript binary, in the sense that you wouldn't want to fork through it. But at the same time, if there are problems, I think it'll just be because you're using libraries that the translator doesn't understand. So you'll be able to kind of go, if I replace that method call with these two, then it's actually fine in the original Java. I mean, for smaller applications, just going in and hacking away at JavaScript is probably still fine, you know? I just think if I were writing a full-on game like Quake, I would not want to write that in JavaScript.
No.
100,000 lines or whatever of JavaScript, which is reasonably hard in my head to structure compared to something like C++, Java, or even C, you know, where you can...
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I mean, I think... I'm not utterly convinced by that strategy, I have to say. I get... There's all kinds of issues about code maintainability and all kinds of things like that that worry me a little bit about that. But as we move on to the conversation about the application space, I mean, we talked about the disparities between the different browsers and the way they implement JavaScript and so on and so forth. And actually, in the work that my company does with the ISAM app, etc., we're seeing there's a lot of JavaScript used in the application for different things, and getting lots of different odd results and odd behaviours as the browsers change and iterate at the moment, and just little bugs coming up and things not working and then working and all kinds of oddities. And that worries me quite a bit. I think that, you know, that if we're going to use JavaScript, it'd be nice to see that much more standardised and get the browsers to implement that correctly. But in terms of the application space, I think what I like about this, the separation of HTML, CSS and JavaScript, is that in the past they've been more of an amalgam. There's been a lot more crossover between them. And so developing an application, you might use a templating engine like Smarty or something like that, for example. And from what I can see, I think you could almost completely do away with the templating engine now. I think that you could, you know, using something like PHP or something like that, you could create an object-orientated MVC type approach that can utilize HTML to give, to basically hand over the data, almost taking like an XML type strategy, really, and passing this is all the content, and then use the CSS to build all the interface. And of course, at the same time, you've got all that wonderful multimedia stuff that you can draw into that as well. And I think that that's got huge scope in that, you know, just those tools in their own right, just HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, can be used in their own right to create some really great interface stuff.
Absolutely.
And I think we'll see a lot more of that as we go forward.
Sorry, yeah.
I was just going to say, well, you see the beginnings of that with the cube, which is using nothing but that stuff. And then you've got 3D objects rotating around. I mean, everything else is extrapolates from there, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, this latest generation is bringing some really nice features with it which help you to actually generate an application, such as the ability to store data which you can then access offline.
Yeah.
So now the browser has a concept of local databases which you can access with JavaScript. So when you downloaded your mail from Google and you happen to load the browser up and I'm on the train and the internet's rubbish, it doesn't matter, it's still there in the local database, more like how a desktop application would do it, as opposed to just having the web browser is kind of a view. It's almost like going the opposite direction to OnLive, isn't it? It's almost like where OnLive has said, oh, you don't want to do all the work locally, we'll do it all on the server and just give you like a window which you can tap on and we'll hear the tapping on the glass and we'll react to it on the other side. In the browser, it's gone the other way. So whereas before, everything was basically, it's almost like it's pretty much rendered on a server. You just didn't see it until it hit your browser. And there were obviously some clever client-side scripts, but for the most part, most web pages were, it's on a pane of glass, it's behind the pane of glass, and you can see this screen which is actually hundreds of miles away and roughly interact with it.
That's such a miserly image. I could just tell the people tapping on the glass, can I please play the game? I'll be with you in a minute. There you go, there's your next graphic.
Well, it's funny, it doesn't seem to sit in one camp or the other, but I like the strategy of what's being done, I have to say that. I mean, I very much like the thin client strategy. Maybe that's perhaps because I come from more old school with mini systems that were with lots of terminals that were all dumb sitting around them, and I like that model. Probably because I like the centralized control. But the client server model is gives a lot more control to the user, I think. And of course, when you up until now, when you've tried to build web applications, I mean, a really classic example is where you couldn't compete is perhaps you want to attach a document, for example, into an app. And if that's a local client-server desktop app, you just literally drag it from one thing, drop it on the interface, and bang, it's there, done. And that is nice and simple. To do that in a web-based app, you've got to choose the file, select the one you want, hit the upload button, and then it takes it a minute to load it up. Of course, you can do away with that now with the new HTML5 widgets that allow you to give you that drag and drop, where it'll take that file, stick it in local temporary storage, and then sync it up in the background. From what I was looking on the Google I/O stuff, watching some of their videos, you can have these concepts of persistent and temporary storage that's allotted to the browser. So you've almost got like any one of the three, you know, you can have like thin client or client server or something in between, because you've got the manifest as well, which is this ability to be able to keep a state and hold that in the browser. So the connection goes down, maybe you are moving between radio points on a mobile network, and the manifest will carry that data and rehook you in so you can resync the connection and stuff like that. And that's exciting stuff because it allows you an aspect of being able to compensate for network unreliabilities. And at the same time, you can probably maintain the user experience, the speed with which the user is interacting, because with a little bit of clever code, you could use that manifest and local temporary storage to compensate. So there's loads of tools that are coming forward to the mix that are really good. I'm a bit concerned about the database side of things, though. You've obviously got, we've got things like SQLite. There seems to be a lot of debate and mixed ideas in camps. You've got this IndexedDB, which a lot of people are rooting for. You've got the idea of more or less almost like a fully fledged database, which Chrome and IE are going for, but the Mozilla Foundation are pitted against. I'd like to see that get resolved. I think I worry about fragmentation. That's the thing that just makes me most nervous about this. It's a great opportunity, HTML5 is. I'm just going to be careful it doesn't get fragmented.
Problem is, if it gets fragmented, then you can't really do it unless you're a massive player who can afford the development time to develop it four times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, for the major browsers. And it's like, I wouldn't be able to do that. You know, I couldn't do that myself and put, well, if it was a massive project, obviously I could, but I wouldn't want to. It's the sort of thing you need a team for, isn't it? And you are the IE person. You are the Chrome and Firefox person, and, you know.
But all of that comes with a whole sequence of problems that, like we've seen before, you know. I mean, if you speak to any web designer and say, what's the biggest bane of their life, is trying to make things work in every browser.
Yeah.
And that's what consumes the greatest amount of time. And you get tripped up by this, and the customer will come along and say, well, you know, the customer's got an Apple, for example, and you've done it all in IE, and then it's all over the place. And that's a real problem. And if that gets exacerbated probably 100-fold when you start talking about trying to develop an application now that's interactive and doing all of these kinds of things. I think it would just, it'll ruin it. It'll just become almost impossible, like you say, unless you've got hundreds of dollars. And if it becomes a big player market space, you lose the innovation.
There's a funny story, actually, from I used to work for a company in Vue called Computoz, and they sold computer games. And I wrote the first interactive website, and it was all written in Perl. Back then, PHP was
awesome.
I don't know if it existed or not, or if it was just that young that I hadn't heard of it, but it was Perl and flat files for the data. And there was someone who sent me an email saying, I've got a few problems being part of your website. I was like, okay, yeah, what's the problem? He sent me back, and I was like, I can't see it, what are you viewing it on? He's like, oh, Amiga OS. I don't care. And I looked in the log files, and there he was, the one user using Amiga OS, and he visited the site every 3 weeks or every 2 weeks or something.
I didn't even realise that Amiga OS had an internet a web browser.
I think he was, you know, running some form of Unix on Amiga or something, you know, I don't know what it was, but it was running on an Amiga.
Oh, you just get. Sometimes you just get some weirdos, don't you? And you know, there are only two words you can really say to them. Outrageous, but so well. I think at the end of the day, I know it's going to be really exciting to see what's going to happen with HTML5, and we've seen quite a bunch of sites have gone over, and you only need to do a few searches on Google, and you can see quite a lot of sites that are using it now to really good effect. You know, it's obviously working really, really well. And I know that, you know, we're starting to look at writing some stuff in, do some stuff in it already. And I'm liking what I'm seeing from the outset. I think it's definitely something that's got a lot of potential.
For me, I'll be really happy when videos and charts and just the basic sort of things don't need Flash anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's going to be a, you know, all this other stuff I think is great, and it's going to be really exciting when these 3D games come out and they use HTML5 and JavaScript, but for the interim, when sites stop using Flash and just start saying, well, if you haven't got the latest browser, tough, you can't view our video.
Yeah.
And you don't need Flash anymore to view videos, and you can view it on your iPad and your phone, and whatever supports playing videos will just play a video in a video tag. I think that's what I'd like to see.
Yeah, a set of standards, unite the clans, basically. make it all flat again, yeah, that's... Everybody can develop for everybody. Yeah, that's the dream. It's a small dream, but it's my dream, you know.
Yeah, we know, Jack.
Living the dream.
Cool. Well, that's takes us to the end of another show, really, and I think that some really interesting stuff discussed in this show. HTML5 was particularly exciting. I think that that's a great tech.
The future always is exciting.
I've already taken down the orbital vector onto my iPad. I'll be looking at that a little bit later with the Google Plus One. That's a great site, that is, Jack.
It's right up your street, yeah.
For me, I think it's nice to get back to some of our deep thought roots again, you know, and start talking proper techie, like about the online stuff. That was good.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was... I want to have a play with that, actually. I think that... I mean, I'm not much of a gamer, I have to say, but I'd like to have a fiddle around with it. I'd definitely like to try and get it working in Wine, because from what I could read, that looks like it's a bit of a challenge. And I like a challenge. You know, and everything should run on Linux. It's outrageous if it doesn't.
To be fair, if it does, though, that will counteract one of my biggest kind of reasons not for moving to Linux. And that is I like playing games. If now I can play any game on Linux, because once the client works, obviously every game it supports works.
Yeah.
So,
That's true for a lot of people as well. There are loads of people out there that say, I have to have Windows because I've got to play games, or, you know, I won't move to Linux or whatever, or people that dual boot. So, sure. You know, I'd love to see that as well. I think that there's a thriving game community there. Maybe we should talk about that on the show at some point. That'd be a really good one.
Yeah, I've got some really good ideas in that field, so...
But and the only thing I've got left to say is I'm off now to go and look at YouTube and WikiLeaks and see whether the Earth really is hollow.
I'm going to go and burrow back into my underground lair, guys. So get as far from that sunlight as I possibly can.
Awesome. Well, I'm Rick Timmis, and I'm going to vanish off out to YouTube and see what's out there.
I've been John Wordsworth, and a heartfelt thanks for listening.
I'm Jackson Matthews. You've made me feel warm and fuzzy, and I will now return the favour by leaving you with a track from Magnitude from a band called Electric Frankenstein, if you can believe it, and the song's called Listen Up, Baby.
John's about to—he's about to graffiti the wall, I reckon.
get a street vibe going in here.
Who knows where it is?
Hip hop rocks.
That's right.
All over the wall.
At Random is now a happening show.
Do you know what? When I was younger, WD-40, I always had a rocket on the side of the can. And as kids, we always thought it was it was some kind of rocket fuel, like, you know. WD-40 was a bolt loosener and rocket fuel.
There we go.
You need to sit in it, John, and just
sit
in it for a second and just lean back and forward and see whether it still squeaks. There's a little bit of a creak going on there, isn't there?
Just douse it. Just needs to get in the right bit, doesn't it? And it's fine.
What an awesome pre-show. The pre-show to At Random is turning the chairs upside down and oiling them.
You wanted random. Here's random.
I wish you people could see this right now.
This is not what techies do. Can I write some code to do this?
I was going to say, haven't you got a script for that? A little bash script ought to sort it out. Hey! No squeak!
Gone are the telltale. Although they were almost in that random trademark.
Awesome.
There we go, At Random 2.0.
No way, the squeak has really gone.
Yeah, that works.
It's just that tiny leather squeak now, which won't get picked up by the mic. So
there's the advert, there it is. The best advert you could possibly get for WD-40. Shall I contact somebody at the company and see whether they want to get a sponsorship? Maybe we can give 10% off, like they do on the Twit Network. 10% off on WD-40. Visit @random/WD-40.
Well, I think the other opportunity is to say, if you don't sponsor us, then I'm afraid we're just going to have to cut that out and put... We're currently spraying the chair with a spray can of lubricant of an unknown origin.
Aldi's own brand.
I used to do a radio show and we were never allowed to mention products. So we had to say a tube of potato snacks.
Oh, Pringles. but people get paid for product placement now, don't we? So, like, you know, like, here we are. Listen to this, people. Yeah. Oh, that wasn't... It did fizz.
It did a little bit, just at the end there.
That's a caramel-flavoured dark drink called Coca-Cola.
Oh.
Oh, magic. Well,